Up next, secret history, the story of cryptology and unsolved. An amazing story. Craig Bauer, our guest. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Craig Bauer with us, expert on codes and ciphers. Dr. Craig Bauer is the editor of a journal devoted to all aspects of cryptology. And in 2011, 2012, he was a scholar in residence at the National Security Agency, the NSA, and the Center for Cryptologic History. And he is currently employed as a professor of mathematics at York College of Pennsylvania. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Craig, how did you get involved in cryptology anyway?
Well, I played with it as a kid, but I had no idea how deep it went. I mean, it was just kind of natural when I had a tree house, you know, in junior high school to make up secret codes and exchange messages. We even had dead drops. But it wasn't until college, I was finishing off a computer science minor, and I needed an independent study. And the professor suggested I do it on encryption. And my response is, what's that? I mean, this was in the early 1990s when, you know, you weren't buying things online with credit cards and I just had no idea that it was anything more than a kid's game. So I'm really grateful to this computer science professor, Jay Anderson, at Franklin Marshall College for kind of opening my eyes to how much bigger this subject was. And I just immediately fell in love with the history of the subject, unsolved ciphers that are still out there, the mathematics that can be applied to it. So it's something that I've been with now for a long time.
And for people who don't know what a cipher is, Craig, why don't you explain that? It has to do with a code.
Yeah, well, if we go back thousands of years, if you wanted to keep a secret, you know, it might be enough just to put it in writing because not many people were literate. But shortly after writing is developed and literacy starts to spread, you want to keep secrets from people that know how to read. So then you need to disguise the writing somehow. So a simple example from Julius Caesar, known as the Caesar shift, is just to shift every letter by three. So if you have, I came, I saw, I conquered, the I would be shifted. Let's see, it's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I. So you shift three more, J, K, L. I becomes L. So I came, the C would become D, E, F. You just shift every letter by three. So the person that receives it just shifts back. So it's a little way of disguising it that you know, somebody comes upon this message. If they don't know anything about ciphers, they might think that it's just gibberish. So now, of course, we have really sophisticated techniques, but that's where the game begins. I mean, the Vikings had similar ciphers. They would shift their runes. So just some way of disguising the writing to fool a person into thinking it's gibberish, or even if they recognize it's a cipher, hopefully they can't break it.
In World War II, there was a machine called the Enigma machine, which the Brits used as codebreakers for trying to decipher German signals. That was a huge breakthrough for us, wasn't it?
Yes. It started off as just a German machine that, you know, it was sold to businesses. It was a commercial machine, so businesses could keep their dealing secret. But the Nazis took over this machine and changed the wiring around and used it for an incredible amount of communication. I mean, historians differ on how much this saved us in being able to break these machine ciphers and gain this intelligence. But, you know, kind of a conservative approach is that it ended World War II a year earlier.
It sure did.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine if we have another year of fighting the Nazis, maybe another year of fighting the Japanese, the concentration camps running full steam for another year. And, you know, it might have been more. Maybe it was 2 years. There was someone really high up in NSA who suggested that it might have been a game changer, that perhaps we would have lost. And he pointed out to, details like how the Battle of the Atlantic was going in our favor when we were reading these communications, being able to determine where the U-boats were and sink them, reroute our own convoys around them. It was, say, second half of 1941. Even with this intelligence, we lost 600,000 tons of ships. But in the second half of 42, when they made changes to Enigma that prevented us from reading it, we lost 2,600,000 tons. I know there are other variables, but, I mean, this was a key factor in knowing where those U-boats were, and, you know, an extra 2 million tons of shipping lost because we were shut out of this intelligence for 6 months. So So it's just unimaginable to me what World War II would have been like without the expert code breakers. You know, and even if it wasn't a game changer, maybe it would have been a sort of a draw where Hitler maintains Fortress Europe to this day. You know, all of Europe is Nazi, that he can't quite conquer England. You know, America's secure, but man, what a great application. When I talk about this in my classes, I call this the greatest application of mathematics ever. I mean, iPhones are neat, but to change the course of World War II, math has just earned its keep.
Craig, have you heard of what is called a numbers station?
Yes.
What are they exactly? Because I get a lot of emails from folks who just think there's some kind of spy ring operation going on, and they hear these numbers via shortwave, and they're going crazy. What are they?
I think that's correct. I think it is spies. I mean, this has gone on all through the Cold War, that you have radio stations that are just broadcasting numbers, just one after the other. I mean, it doesn't make for very exciting listening.
Right.
But there are people who follow these closely and copy down all the numbers and then try to figure out, you know, what sort of cipher this might be.
Is it like a human voice?
Sometimes it's a computerized voice, but on other occasions it's been human. And, you know, we sort of have an updated version of these today, postings on Reddit. So, you know, the technology has been updated. But this is a wonderful way to communicate with a spy. You don't have to sneak a message to him. You don't need couriers. You just make sure that your spy has a shortwave radio or access to the internet, and he gets the information he needs, you know, decodes it on a little piece of paper that he then burns or flushes down the toilet, and we got communication going in one direction.
How do you break that kind of a code?
Well, the first step would be trying to figure out what the system is. So, I mean, there's just thousands of different methods that could be used to disguise a message. And there's a chance that it's the one unbreakable method. I mean, you can bang your head against the cipher for years, and if it happens to be a one-time pad, you'll never get it. It's kind of interesting that it was back in the 1940s, Claude Shannon, the father of information theory, proved that there's only one unbreakable cipher, only one way of doing it, that even if you have the world's best computers working on it for a million years, you'll never be able to figure out what it says. It's something known as the one-time pad.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually pretty simple to explain, but if these number stations are using that and they're using it properly, the people trying to break the messages don't stand a chance.
Jeez.
But it's not a very practical system, so they might be using something that could be broken.
Could they be broadcasting to terrorist cells or things like that?
Yes, that's a possibility. It's believed that a lot of the number stations from the Cold War were, you know, spies, like, say, Russian spy networks and such. But terrorists could certainly be making use of that technology. There's a claim that they were communicating using steganography. That's where you hide a message inside an image somehow.
All right. Give me an example, if you could.
Yeah, so the claim goes. I mean, this is all still classified, so we don't have a smoking gun yet. But you could have two identical images. You take one of them, and you just change the colors of the pixel by the tiniest amount. You have a long number of zeros and ones that represents the color of that pixel. And if you just change the last digit from a zero to a one, or from a one to a zero, you're not going to be able to tell a difference just visually inspecting these images. So what they could do is change that last bit, that last zero or one, in the color of every pixel to represent their message instead, and then post this somewhere online. Then the spy or the terrorist who wants to get the message just downloads that image, and, you know, he has computer software that'll look at the last bit for each pixel,
right,
and reconstruct it. So the claim is that terrorists were communicating in this manner using pornographic images.
Huh.
So there's software out there that you can use, you know, without having to know, you know, computer science or mathematics, to detect if it looks like a message is embedded in an image.
What's the big purpose, Craig? I'm going to ask you about some ancient ciphers in a second here, but
sure.
What is the initial purpose of a cipher or a code? What are they trying to hide? Something dastardly or what?
In many cases, certainly. So, I mean, it's very important to spies, to terrorists, but also to businessmen. They just want to keep their industrial secrets. They know that other large businesses, competitors, might be spying on them, trying to figure out how much they're bidding on a large contract, trying to steal business. So there are, you know, more pleasant uses such as that. And sometimes it's just of religious significance. You know, today some Jews will not write God. If you write God on a piece of paper, that piece of paper could be torn or thrown away or become soiled, and it would be disrespectful from their perspective. So they'll write G-D.
Huh.
You know, just a little way of disguising it.
Right.
Many older ciphers are just set in serious religious context. That they'll encipher a prayer. So that's another more pleasant use. And also just, you know, people who want privacy. You order something, say, from Amazon. You want your credit card number protected. It's just so easy for people to intercept online communications.
Right.
So there are plenty of uses for us, you know, as well as for the bad guys. So that's sort of the trick. How do you... I mean, there's really no way I know of to do this, but ideally you would keep this technology out of the hands of terrorists, but still have it available to internet shoppers.
Exactly. When you're online and it says encrypted, what does that mean?
Well, it could use a variety of algorithms, but some of the more modern techniques initially developed in the 1970s allow you to communicate with the website even though you haven't already agreed on a secret key. Like, you know, prior to the 1970s, if I wanted to send an enciphered message to you, we'd have to agree on a system and what the key is. So for like the Caesar shift, we shift every letter by 3. Or we could change it and say we'll shift every letter by 5. But we'd have to agree on that ahead of time. Now, if I had a way of calling you up with no eavesdropper so we could agree on a key, why wouldn't I just convey my message that way?
Exactly.
So this was a huge problem. How do you establish secure communication when you don't have a secure line to do it over, when you know people are eavesdropping? I mean, there are a lot of computers between me and Amazon. So this new technique that was developed in the 70s relies on mathematics that goes back to the 1600s, but it allows a vendor to have one key that we can use to encipher messages. That's publicly known. Everybody can encipher using this key, but they have a completely different key to decipher the message, to recover it again. So it's something that was thought to be impossible for, you know, hundreds of years, that you needed a key that both parties could use. But a clever application of hundreds of years old mathematics allowed them to have one key that everybody can send messages to, and knowing that doesn't help you figure out how to decipher somebody else's message.
Craig Bauer with us. The ancients used ciphers a lot. What were they trying to hide, Craig?
Well, basically a lot of the same things as today, with the exception of credit card numbers. Like I said, Julius Caesar used it for military secrets. People of a religious bent used it to disguise prayers and invocations, things that were too special to them to just write in a plain script. But we have many back from even ancient Egypt, the Vikings, ancient Greece, that we still can't read. So it's incredible. The techniques are so simple. I'm trying to draw some attention to those in my most recent book, and I believe some of these will be unraveled.
What are some of the oldest unsolved ciphers that are out there?
Well, I think the ancient Egyptians would be the oldest. There was a sarcophagus, a small one, very small, that was thought to be a hoax, you know, something manufactured maybe to rip off a tourist. People go to Egypt and they want to come back with, you know, artifacts from, you know, whichever dynasty. And so this tiny sarcophagus looks almost like a toy. And another reason it was thought to be a hoax was that the hieroglyphics on it didn't make any sense. Well, not long ago, they used some sort of X-ray technology, and they discovered there's a reason the sarcophagus was so tiny. It contained a mummified fetus. So to me, this is, you know, incredible evidence that it's real. I mean, who is going to, you know, have a miscarriage and then you know, mummify the fetus. I mean, this is a very traumatic moment in a couple's life.
Oh, sure.
And then just have gibberish scrawled on it, hieroglyphs that are meaningless. I can't believe that. This is an incredibly serious context, and it jumped out at me that this is real. This is too grisly to fake or hoax, that it's real, and there's some meaning here. I dug a little deeper, and I learned that this sort of thing is common. Across many dynasties, we have sarcophagi with inscriptions that the experts can't read. And the ancient Egyptians are known to have used ciphers. They not only changed the hieroglyphs to other hieroglyphs, they would sometimes rearrange them, put them in some different order. So this is something I think that, you know, we maybe need a team effort, maybe Egyptologists working together with experts on codes and ciphers and figure out what's going on and not just dismiss, you know, all this, again, you know, secret history. The Egyptian cryptology kept advancing from the old kingdom to the new kingdom. And right now they only understand the oldest, most primitive examples. New kingdom cryptography is an open field for anyone willing to spend the time to look at and learn more.
Craig's latest book, Unsolved, The History and Mystery of the World's Greatest Ciphers from Ancient Egypt to Online Secret Societies. Tell me about these secret societies. What are they using this for?
Yeah, so there's a really neat story involving a website purported to be from the Knights Templar.
Uh-huh. A so, website?
You know, yeah. If they were still around, why wouldn't they go digital?
That's right.
So this website was put up, and it was really neat. All kinds of little puzzles, little ciphers, and things to explore. Like, you have an image, but it's completely black. Okay, so why did they put this black image on this webpage? There's nothing there. But you plug it into an image editing program and click autocorrect, and suddenly you see a pyramid.
Ah, okay.
It was you know, the contrast was changed so it would look all black, but really you had slightly different shades that your eye couldn't perceive.
But you could only see it through either a computer or maybe special glasses or something?
Oh, that might be another possibility. I happen to find it through a computer program, but so you see a pyramid. Okay, there's a pyramid on this website, and there are runes across the pyramid, and that's a cipher that can be broken. And, you know, there are things spelled backwards and mysterious strings of numbers. So this was a fabulous website back in 2010 to kind of pursue and see how much you could unravel. You know, whether you believe it's truly the Knights Templar or not, it's a fun game to, you know,
right,
follow the links and see what you can learn. There are poems there. So very interesting. So the website is now down, but it can be accessed through the Wayback Internet Time Machine.
Who took it down? Did somebody take it down?
Well, it came down, the Wayback Internet Time Machine has archived versions from different dates. So when it finally came down, they posted a disclaimer. We are in no way connected to the idiot in Norway. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, that's funny.
This website was built in 2010 to show the world how easy it is to start a conspiracy. Corrips.com also is part of the hoax. And it continues on.
Craig, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more as we talk about Unsolved, the history and mystery of the world's greatest ciphers from ancient Egypt to online secret societies. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Craig Bauer with us. His latest work is called Unsolved, the history and the mystery of the world's greatest ciphers from ancient Egypt to online secret societies. And Craig's website, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Craig, are there some unsolved ciphers from way, way back?
Yes, we have those examples from ancient Egypt on the sarcophagi. We also have giant rune stones made by the Vikings that the experts dismiss as gibberish, that maybe it was an illiterate person carving the stone, but they're beautifully carved, and it's a hell of a lot of work if it doesn't mean something. So I suspect that those are ciphers. The Vikings are known to have had ciphers as good as those of the ancient Greeks and Romans. We also have examples in ancient Greece. there are these vases, mostly from Athens, Attic mm-hmm. vases, that sometimes on the same vase you'll have a meaningful message painted on it, and then gibberish in the same handwriting.
Huh.
So a woman from Stanford, a professor, Adrian Mayor, was able to unravel some of these. She looked at ones that had Amazons on them, Amazon warriors, and took the meaningless inscriptions and sent them off to somebody without any context, an expert on the languages the Amazons would have spoken if they were real. And he came back with decipherments of these. Just like, you know, we can write a Japanese word like katana or Mitsubishi or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not an English word. If somebody only knows English, they'll say this is nonsense. It turns out that some of these painted words were foreign words rendered with the Greek alphabet. So she actually got meaningful messages back. In most instances, they were the names of these Amazon warriors. It turns out, sort of like some Native Americans, they would have names that connect with some childhood incident. Like, you know, if a bear ran past when the kid was born, he might be called Running Bear. So the Amazon warriors had nicknames like this. So it was interesting. One deciphered to iron, and these were believed to be some of the first people to use iron weapons. Another, on the vase, Hercules was fighting the Amazons. I mean, this happened often, but usually he was by himself. On this particular vase, he had like two or three other guys helping him out. So, you know, why does he have help all of a sudden? Well, the name of an Amazon warrior actually deciphered to enthusiastic sex. So you know, all of a sudden, you know, people are willing to show up and lend a hand, you know, not too worried about if they get captured and what might happen.
We have something called SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And they're trying to listen for primarily radio signals from other star systems, hoping that maybe there's some intelligent signal there. Is it conceivable, if we ever get a signal, that it could be a cipher, a coded message?
Yeah, there was a great example from, I'm trying to look at the date. I think it was the 1920s. An astronomer set up an experiment. Mars was at one of its closest approaches, and he wanted to listen in case some radio messages were being broadcast from Mars. And he did pick up some sort of message. He got something. He wasn't sure what to make of it. And it was turned over to one of America's top code breakers. So it was William Friedman. He had a long career with the precursor organizations up through what became the National Security Agency. So they actually named their auditorium, their main auditorium is named after William Friedman. But I thought, how cool is that? That as a code breaker, you're the go-to guy if they think they have intercepted alien communications, that your skill at breaking ciphers might help you unravel this alien message. So he didn't make any sense of it, and it's now realized that really it was not a message from Mars, that this astronomer, if he had collected some more data, thought about it some more, done some more experiments, might have discovered radio astronomy.
Interesting tech. Now, Craig, ciphers have been used also in attempts to try to prove that there is life after death. How have they worked that way?
Well, suppose I create a cipher that is so complicated, nobody can break it without knowing the key.
Right, okay.
And the key could be a word or a phrase, just something I have to keep secret. But if you know that key, then you could unravel the message. But I don't tell anybody. I write this message down and, you know, I make it available. I don't tell anybody the key. Then I die. And then after I die, I try to communicate the key to you. And if I can successfully somehow communicate from beyond the grave and reveal the key to you, maybe through a medium or through, you know, you have a dream and you see me and I tell you the key, and then you unravel the cipher, this would be taken as proof that you communicated with me, because there's no other way to break this cipher.
Right. I needed to speak to you to get it.
Exactly. So this is what various parapsychologists, from Robert Thouless to Ian Stevenson, I mean, we have a string of these, Arthur Berger, have all tried to do. But in many cases, they picked a cipher that wasn't quite strong enough. So this is kind of like a game for people that are code breakers to try to see if they could recover this message using their computer instead of a medium. So One thing I respect with all these researchers is that none of them tried to fake it. They were all sincere and made honest efforts. No one, you know, secretly told the key to a medium and had it revealed after their deaths. I mean, they all failed, but they failed honestly. So this is a great idea, but, you know, so far it hasn't given any good evidence because, you know, we had that challenge of finding something that can't be broken any other way. Actually, there's still some, one or two by Thallus that have yet to be recovered. So it'll be interesting if they're ever broken, if it's by a computer or by other means.
What are criminal ciphers?
All kinds of criminals make use of ciphers going, you know, from simple pencil and paper methods to advanced computer techniques. So the FBI actually has a cryptanalytic unit that's their job is to break these criminal ciphers. And about 80% of what they attack are ciphers created by people in jail. So you have a gang leader, he's arrested, he's going to be in jail for a long time perhaps, but he's still running his gang.
Yeah.
You know, he's communicating in various secret ways, smuggling messages in and out, ordering hits. There was an incredible case involving the Aryan Brotherhood. There was a rival gang that was mostly concentrated in one or two jails, and for some reason they decided to disperse these people and put them in jails across the country. And the Aryan Brotherhood decided they wanted to send a message that they were in charge, and they communicated across the nation, okay, all their different prison chapters, as it were. Let's kill one guy from this gang at every prison they're being moved into, and let's do it in this 15-minute time span just to send a message. We're in charge.
Yeah.
So they communicated this with ciphers, and one guy acted on it early. I think he killed somebody the day before. So there was a lockdown, and it was the ciphers were uncovered and broken, and then they prevented more deaths from occurring. But it's incredible what these criminals can do locked up. And, of course, the ones that are out walking the streets have much more freedom and use everything under the rainbow to encipher. You know, some of them think that NSA can break all these modern ciphers, so they fall back on these old systems that are actually easier to break. So it's all still seeing use. It's not dead history. It's every cipher system still alive somewhere.
Craig, how intelligent do you have to be able to interpret or even decipher a cipher?
Well, I think more important than intelligence is imagination and persistence. So you were asking about criminal ciphers. The Zodiac Killer, active in California for a number of years.
Oh, sure. He had it down to a science, didn't he?
Yeah, oh, some of his ciphers are still unsolved. But his very first cipher was solved by a high school history teacher and his wife. So you don't have to have formal training in math or computer science. He spent about 22 hours and cracked it. And his wife had no knowledge of cryptology, but she had knowledge of psychology.
Well, how do you crack something like that when you have no idea what it is?
Well, she got inside the killer's head. She realized this guy wants a lot of attention. He's writing letters
right.
to newspapers, so he wants attention. He's egotistical. She thought the message is going to begin I, and it did. And she also guessed the word kill would appear in the message, and it
brilliant,
did.
Brilliant.
And yeah, so that psychological insight is huge. Like World War II code breakers, you know, being able to guess that the message ends Heil Hitler or, you know, begins Herr Oberkommandant Vermacht or, you know, like these long titles. And so you get your foot in the door using psychology, using imagination, just being clever. It's not just a science, it's also an art. So, you know, when I wrote this book on unsolved ciphers, I mean, there are scores of examples. And a lot of them were created by amateurs, and I think amateurs can solve some of these. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to these being unraveled. Actually, two of them were unraveled as I was writing it. As I was writing this book, I was
really?
Going around delivering lectures, and this led to two of them getting more attention and being solved.
What has been the strangest cipher you've come across?
Oh, the strangest. I might say the Voynich manuscript.
Now, what is that?
So it was actually carbon dated. It goes back to the 1400s, and it's over 200 pages long. So normally the longer ciphers are easier to break because you have so much more to work with. And this one's filled with images, just strange images of plants that the botanists say don't even exist. And you have sort of celestial images. I mean, it looks like it deals with astrology or astronomy. Maybe it's an herbal. It has possibly anatomical diagrams, maybe about blood flow. It kind of looks like pipes. It's just, you know, hundreds of mysterious illustrations, hundreds of pages of text. It looks like an incredibly simple cipher, but nobody's been able to break it. Some of the best minds in the history of code breaking have gone at it and failed. So that's a really strange one. It was actually purchased for 600 gold ducats by King Rudolf II. This was a guy the Catholic Church thought needed to be exorcised. I mean, he had no interest in ruling. He was just pursuing occult wisdom with all of his energy, buying books. Again, 600 gold ducats for this one, which might contain, you know, deep secrets. He thought it was written by Roger Bacon. Sorry, I had the wrong century. Yeah, I mean, this guy put an incredible passion into alchemy and just all the dark arts. He was looking for the philosopher's stone, trying to live forever. And he gets this manuscript and frustratingly so can't make anything of it. And for centuries, that's remained the case. So I think that one's the most mysterious. Entire books have been devoted to the Voynich manuscript.
You know, I keep thinking of Albert Einstein, and he did all his computations either by hand or on a chalkboard. He did not have a computer. When you look at ciphers today versus what they had then, was it harder or easier if you had a computer, let's say, to be able to do your deciphering?
Well, some people think the computer complicates everything, that, you know, if the cipher is made on a computer, it's going to be way harder to break. But, you know, sometimes it's the opposite, because we have tricks that we can use to get ciphers from computers that we don't even have to break it. Like, let's say you're in a hotel room and you're typing up a message. You're going to encipher it and send it by email, but first you have to type it. There could be somebody in the room next door. Okay, he can't see, there's a solid wall there. He's in the room next door. But he can, with special equipment, pick up the electromagnetic radiation coming off your monitor and reproduce the screen. It's called Van Eck freaking. So you might have an awesome computer encryption algorithm, but he steals the message right off your monitor without laying eyes on it before it's even enciphered. And all kinds of hacking attacks. There are ways that you can, you know, if you hide a microphone, record the noise the computer makes when it enciphers a message and use that to figure out the key. So all kinds of crazy attacks. These are called side channel attacks that bypass all the sophisticated math and steal the message. So in some ways, you know, modern encryption can be weaker than an old pencil and paper system. But, you know, also on the flip side, computers help us break those old paper and pencil systems. So it's this constant battle back and forth. The computer can be a dangerous thing. You know, if you're using a modern system, you better implement it securely. There are a lot of ways to go wrong, but it can also help break older systems.
What do you think Albert Einstein would have been like had he had a computer then?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of these great scientists and mathematicians from the past would have, you know, given their right arm for a computer. I mean, it's amazing. And not just having this computing power, but that scientists have the whole history of their subject and all their peers within easy reach. I mean, it used to be if you wanted a research paper, you know, you think it might be relevant to your work, you request a research paper through, say, interlibrary loan and get it a week or two later. Now you just instantly download it. So everything's accelerating.
Has technology, Craig, changed, you know, what you do and what the other people who are involved in ciphers do?
Oh, sure. The books I've written would have taken me a lifetime before the internet. Like I said, just to have the whole history of our subject, everything sure. Available rapidly.
Oh, so, heck, I remember talk shows back in the, when was it? Even 1990, you would go into your studio with newspaper clippings and magazine clippings and all these things that you wanted to talk about. Nowadays, you go online and you put together a concise packet in a, you know, matter of moments.
Yes. So, yeah, they don't call it the information age for nothing. The late 1500s, maybe early 1600s, a mathematician, John Napier, invented logarithms, which made it easier to do some calculations. You want to multiply two numbers together. Instead, you find their logs and add them a lot easier. And it was said that by having their calculations, he doubled the life of the astronomer, that astronomers that had a career of 20 years could now do 40 years worth of work.
Wow.
But now, you know, we're far beyond that. So, I mean, the potential for scientists now is just so much greater. They can, you know, in their prime years, do 10 times what they could have, you know, just 30 years ago. Everything's accelerating. Cryptology's part of that.
Have codes and ciphers changed the world?
Oh, yeah. Like I mentioned before, shortening World War II by a year or two, maybe even being a game changer. A broken code led to revenge for Pearl Harbor. It was the architect of Pearl Harbor, Admiral Yamamoto, had his itinerary provided through a code broken by the Americans. They knew exactly where he was going to be, when he was going to be there, and sent some of their best ace pilots to shoot him down.
And he woke up a sleeping giant in us, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, wonderful payback. I mean, imagine being the guy that broke that code and knowing that you're finally going to get payback for Pearl Harbor.
Exactly. Craig, we're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast and take phone calls in our final hour with you as we talk about codes and ciphers.